Don't let yourself get attached to anything you are not willing to walk out on in 30 seconds flat if you feel the heat around a corner.
And welcome, everybody, to Podcasting Them Softly, episode number 2, where we will be discussing Michael Mann's Heat, the top 5 performances from Mark Ruffalo and Jessica Chastain, covering some new releases, some trailers, some recent revisits via Blu-ray, any acquisitions for the week. And I'm joined here by Frank. How you doing, Frank?
Hello.
Excited for another chat?
Yes, I am. I have heat on in the background as we speak.
Very good. Good background noise. Well, we won't waste any time. We'll jump right into stuff. We didn't talk about it last week, even though that it had been out already. Furious 7, which we should at least make note of in the sense that it is a motion picture that has grossed $1 billion worldwide. And I know, Frank, you are not a Fast and the Furious aficionado.
No. No, not at all. I haven't seen any of them. But I will say I would see the new one because I absolutely love Kurt Russell. And I know you told me that Kurt Russell's in it briefly, but he is pretty cool in it.
Yep. He has a brief but memorable couple scenes, some good scenes there of action and stuff. I've watched all of the movies throughout the years. I still think that the fifth are the best. The first being sort of like just, you know, this little riff on a Roger Corman, you know, sort of low budget, mid budgeted movie that was kind of on the nose and cheesy, but, you know, was fun, kind of low rent. And then it's just like spectacular what has happened with that series. I mean, you know, I'm not going to comment on the overall quality of all these different movies and filmmaking to it. But what I am going to say is spectacular about it is how they have morphed from a street racing dynamic to a team up of a heist and then sort of a, you know, global sort of Bourne Bond, you know, riffing with all this different stuff while still retaining the car love and all the, you know, exotic automobiles that they want to showcase. But it's a series that has morphed throughout the last 15 years. And typically, even in some of the series that have gone on to have different directors shooting them where they have different personalities, that series has just exploded in a way that I don't think people really ever would have thought after that first one. Having said all that, the latest one was just unbelievably synthetic. There's really nothing about it that I can say that I, you know, loved at all, aside from a couple of, you know, really good looking shots here and there. It's a totally absurd idea. It abandons any sort of sense of logic. It's a complete cartoon. And you know, when you're watching that sort of thing in the moment, it's enjoyable, I guess, on the same sort of level that when you're eating a Big Mac, it goes in, you know, goes in one end and out the other very quickly. That's sort of what these disposable movies are. And I think that's why they make so much money is because you sit down and you know what to expect and you're going to get it. You know, and I just find it hysterical that they've been received so well the last few, especially as they've gotten bigger with the budgets and crazier with the special effects and, you know, divorcing themselves even more from reality. And yet the critics seem to really enjoy these films, whereas if, like, Michael Bay's name was on them, they'd be in, you know, destroyed critically and, you know, they'd still probably make a lot of money. But it's fascinating to see Rotten Tomatoes scores in the 70s and 80s. And I think in the instance, of Fast Five, And to the credit there, Fast Five is a lot of fun. I would say, honestly, skip them all and just watch Fast Five. Like, you know, they don't even need to see any of the other ones, you know, and just jump in right there. I thought that was the best one overall. But this latest one is just so ridiculous and you just can't take any of it seriously. And it makes me yearn for the simplicity of something like Freebie and the Bean or, you know, Ronin, you know, where at least the car chases were being done for real and there was actual stakes involved. And, you know, I know it's a totally different thing, but, you know, just making comparisons as I see them.
Right. I've never really had much interest in them. I don't really care for Vin Diesel. I liked him a lot as the voice of Groot. That's probably my favorite thing that he's done.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
yeah.
I just don't care for him. I like Paul Walker a lot. Obviously in like the Wayne Kramer films, he's especially Running Scared. He's fantastic. Pawn Shop Chronicles. He's unbelievable.
Yeah. Wayne certainly seemed to get great use out of them, and especially in Running Scared. I mean, I just, you know, we're going to have a dedicated podcast to that one in the near future. And, you know, I think that's still Paul's, you know, that was easily his best performance. And, you know, and it was when he was one of those guys that just, you know, he had that smile, he had that look. He was, you know, he was just such a good looking guy, and he was getting better as he went along. And you could have sort of seen him take, you know, some of the roles that maybe Statham wasn't going to take, you know what I mean? Maybe down the road, like those Steve McQueen-esque action roles. I was sort of seeing him maybe, you know, get into that. But think about Pleasantville. He was wonderful
right.
in the movie, where he just like steals every scene as this guy, you know, this wonderfully naive guy caught up in the realm of everything. And I just loved his performance there. That was when he was, you know, breaking out. Wasn't he in Varsity Blues or one of those things too?
Yeah, he was in Varsity Blues. Wasn't he the quarterback yep. that got injured? He could have easily had the career that Chris Pine has. I don't think Chris Pine's anything spectacular. Yep. And I think Paul Walker definitely could have, like, added more depth to the roles of Chris Pine.
Yeah, I think I like Pine. I haven't had a problem with him. I think that when Pine, I think when he surrounds himself like an Unstoppable, like I really enjoyed him there in the Tony Scott film with Denzel, because he was paired with somebody of like with gravitas, you know what I mean? And I thought he did well there. But yeah, you're right. I mean, and it comes down to the whole notion of who are our true movie stars at this point? Like, who are the real leading men? Like, you know, and as I've been going and watching a lot of films recently from the 70s and the 80s, you know, I can't think about some of these films, you know, because Hollywood loves to remake everything. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, who would play this role or who would play that role? And I can't think of some of these movies that have these great roles, because there are no more, in my opinion, true movie stars. Everybody's got baggage and everybody's got this, that, or the other thing, or they become known for something. But in any event, the other one that recently saw, I know you haven't seen yet, was the new Noah Baumbach film, While We're Young, with Ben Stiller, Naomi Watts, Adam Driver, and Amanda Seyfried. I've been a big fan of Noah Baumbach's work overall. The Squid and the Whale from, you know, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago. Absolutely loved that film. I thought it was just brilliant. I thought the work that he's done in between has been a mix of good to very good to excellent. But While We're Young, in my opinion, is easily the best film he's made since Squid and the Whale. It's basically a relationship dramedy that's dark and dry and witty in all the ways that he is, but it has an extremely perceptive view of marriage and of society and the importance or the sort of obsession that people place on parenting and children. And then there's a wonderful sort of, you know, compare and contrast between these people in their 40s who aren't sure exactly if they've made all the right choices and are sort of wondering where the world's going to take them, when they meet these two idealistic, opportunistic 20-year-olds who sort of break them out of their shell. And I just thought it was fantastic. It spoke to me. I thought it was, the writing was wonderful. Ben Stiller, when he teams up with Baumbach, as he did in Greenberg, which I really enjoyed. I think that's a very underrated film, very smart. I think that he gets the most out of Ben Stiller as a dramatic actor who can be very effective. But Naomi Watts really steals the scene throughout the film in numerous instances, playing a woman with a very, very complex emotional role, taking her to some interesting places. I don't want to spoil too much about the film because it's rich. And it's one of those things where, too, when you leave the film and you think about it, as I have over the last couple of days, I really like the decisions that Baumbach made and various points. So when you get a chance to see it, maybe we'll circle back on a Blu-ray thing and we can talk about it, because I think it's an excellent film, and I think it's worth, you know, the time if anybody wants to go see quality filmmaking. So now I think that you should probably lead off into the next segment.
Right. Yeah, I haven't been to the theater in quite a while, but I did get a chance to watch A Most Violent Year last night, which I watched for our Jessica Chastain performances, because I had not seen that before. I love the filmmaker. I absolutely love the film. I mean, we spoke about this, but it's so subtle. The entire film is subtle. It's filled with just subtle performances, subtle themes. It's just, I enjoyed it so much more than I thought I would. And it was really surprising to me that movie didn't get any nominations or much press. I mean, Oscar Isaac and Chastain were great in it. And, of course, Albert Brooks, who's just become like this, he's sort of reinvented himself from what he was in the 80s to now, well, particularly with Drive, kind of set that ball rolling, where he's just taking on these, like, meaty dramatic performances, and he's excellent. But anyway, a big day happened where what was it, Thursday?
Yeah, I think it all. I think Thursday? The madness started.
It all. Everything started Thursday. First, it was the Hateful Eight teaser, like kind of officially got released, which wasn't much of a teaser. Tarantino's next film. There's no footage in it. It's just kind of this nice little trailer where it introduces the characters and kind of sets you up for this huge bloody tale of a Western that's going to be Tarantino's next film, Hateful Eight. And then boom, Star Wars Celebration happened and the Force Awakens trailer came out. And like, I stopped what I was doing at work. I can't even remember what I was doing at work, but I pulled it up on my phone and I watched it. I probably watched it like 6 or 7 times. And the teaser was excellent. I didn't think it was going to be what it was. I thought it was just going to kind of be like another like quick, like, we're just going to show you a couple scenes from the film and not really say much, which I think the trailer was perfect because it shows you so much of the film, but you have no idea what's going on.
And it was a good build on the first one that they released.
Exactly.
It feels like,
and
you know, there'll be a third trailer where they're going to blow your mind with all sorts of crazy action, but it feels like the first one was a nice bite. And then this one is a couple of bites and then we're going to get, you know, the big, big bite coming up soon. So that'll be fun.
I mean, you get to see Han and Chewie at the end of the trailer on the Falcon. I mean, I couldn't even believe that was in the trailer. And when I saw that, I was just like, oh, my God, because I thought Abrams was going to save the classic characters for us and not really show much of any of it throughout any of the trailers. And we were just going to have to wait till the film. Because, I mean, you see Hamill and you hear his voice. You hear Luke and see him, but you don't see him. You know what I mean? You see him behind the cloak, touching R2 with his hand and stuff like that. But, I mean, you get a full shot of Chewie and Han at the end of the trailer. And that made my fucking day.
Yeah.
I mean, it made more than my day, man. It was just like, it was like a moment I had been waiting for since, like, childhood, was to see, like, Chewie and Han now and brand new. And not in a film that came out 30 years ago,
absolutely,
or 20 years ago when I first saw it, or whenever it was. And then, yeah, oh, God. I mean, I just can't even say how much I love that trailer and how much I love Star Wars. Like, Star Wars is my biggest thing in my life. The Ewoks especially. It's all about the Ewoks, man. And the Ewoks have to make some sort of appearance in this new trilogy. I really hope so.
I hope so, too. And I, from what I gather, I'll get into my thoughts in a second, but Warwick Davis, I believe, is listed in the credits, but they don't have – or he's listed
right
on IMDb, but they don't have what character he's playing, so we're all left to speculate that possibly Wicket comes in and is going to make some sort of triumphant return.
That would be excellent. But, I mean, he was in Phantom Menace. It's like usually
yeah.
they cast him
yeah, they go,
as
yeah.
just some like generic character in a mask or whatever. And then all that happened. And then right after the Force Awakens trailer came out, it broke that Ryan Gosling is going to co-star with Harrison Ford in the Blade Runner sequel.
Which,
I was just like,
yep.
I couldn't even believe it. How perfect.
Yeah, and after securing a guy like, I think is how you pronounce his name, is Denis Villeneuve or Denis Villeneuve. The French-Canadian guy who directed Enemy and Prisoners and Incendies, which is excellent. To me, the idea of making a sequel to Blade Runner is almost sacrilegious in some sense. But if you're going to do it and Ridley Scott is going to produce and you're going to get a filmmaker who so far has mixed, from what I've seen, style with smarts, you could do a lot worse than this Villeneuve guy. And of course, getting a guy like Gosling who projects, he's a guy who plays everything close to the vest. And I think that will probably fit very well within the realm of the of that dark sort of dystopian science fiction thing that they're going to do. So I'm very curious. I'm cautiously optimistic is what I'll say.
And then that night, the Batman vs. Superman trailer got leaked because it played in like Brazil or something like that. And somebody took a video of it on their phone and it was actually pretty decent quality. It was a little blurry at times and it got uploaded on YouTube, was taken down, and then BuzzFeed and all sorts of other sites had it up. But Zack Snyder released it the next day. And I was blown away by that trailer too. As soon as they announced that Ben Affleck was going to play Batman, and like the internet threw the shit fit about it.
Every time somebody gets cast as Batman, we have to have a shit fit for 3 months. It's the way it works. Doesn't matter.
Ben Affleck's going to be perfect, and this trailer shows that he's going to be perfect. He's older. he's older. I'm guessing he's supposed to be in his 50s. You can see the gray in Affleck's hair.
Certainly.
And it's gotten to the point. It's gotten to the point in the storyline of this film and in the new Warner Brothers building towards the Justice League is Batman's older and he's more jaded and he's angrier. And what I liked about the trailer and what I'm assuming they're going to be doing is there's going to be no more Batman origin, which I love. We know where Batman came from.
Yes.
It's like taking a page from Tim Burton's film where Batman already exists in the world. We all know who Batman is.
Yep.
And let's just tell the story because we don't need to keep – just origin stories are so overdone now.
I agree.
And just the trailer was – fantastic with the building of how Superman is either worshipped or hated by people, and he's almost become this fallen idol, and it's look what he brought to the world by coming here, this absolute destruction. And then you get the Jeremy Irons voiceover as Alfred, which I absolutely loved because I love Jeremy Irons and I think it's fantastic he's going to play Alfred. And it all builds to the new Bat super suit and the showdown between Batman and Superman and how they're going to fight. And I absolutely loved it. And I loved the super suit. And I particularly loved the new voice that Batman has, this oversynthesized voice. I just thought was such a fantastic idea.
You can tell
it's Ben Affleck's voice, but it's just synthesized and it's dark and I loved it. I don't want to take anything away from the Force Awakens trailer because I thought that was the better trailer and going to be the better movie. I know your standpoint. I saw some comments with you on Facebook about the Batman vs. Superman trailer and it kind of broke my heart a little bit, but we're good there.
But I shouldn't have broken your heart. I'm going to go in reverse in my response to stuff. first off, just to before I get into my excitement for Batman versus Superman, Dawn of Justice, whatever the hell they want to call it, I absolutely loved Man of Steel. I will defend that movie till the day I die. That was the Superman.
I'm with you 100%.
That was the Superman movie that I was waiting my entire life to see on the big screen. It was visually dynamic in a way that I could never have dreamed. I thought that Zack Snyder did a fantastic thing, which was not to make a remake of anything else that had come before it. He didn't repeat the same scenes that we've seen in the other Superman movies. The vivid look at Krypton was wonderful. I loved all the casting. It made my top 10 of the year. It's my favorite blockbuster in forever. I am going to probably spontaneously combust when I'm in the theater watching Batman versus Superman. They were my two favorites when I was a kid. They were always my go-to superheroes. I was always a DC guy over Marvel. I am Marveled out at this point. Every Marvel movie to me looks the same. I'm sort of tired of everything needing to have a joke at the end of it. I love the real world sensibility that Nolan brought to his Dark Knight trilogy. I loved all three films. And I really enjoyed how Man of Steel felt like a combination of Nolan's aesthetic, Snyder's aesthetic, which is certainly different. And now this one looks almost like Zack Snyder Unleashed, which is going to be, you know, for me, very exciting. I have loved Zack Snyder's movies, pretty much all of them. I can't really think of anyone that I don't like. Even the Owl movie was cool. You know, it was at least a subversive kids movie instead of just pandering to their base instincts and desires.
I agree with you 100%. Man of Steel, I absolutely loved. And if you're going to make a realistic Superman movie that could be set in the real world, I thought Man of Steel was the perfect way of doing it.
Absolutely.
I absolutely loved it.
So I'm super psyched for it. As far as Star Wars goes, I was a disciple of the original trilogy when I was a tot. There was nothing greater than the Ewoks. I watched Empire Strikes Back 7,000 times. They will always be near and dear to my heart. You know, the whole thing. For me, what lost me and what sort of soured me were the movies that Lucas made. I thought that they were profound disappointments, especially the first and second one. The third one I thought was pretty good. the Sith movie, especially the end there on the volcano and whatnot. I thought that was fun. But I just didn't – I've tried rewatching them. I can't. They didn't strike me as the same. And people forget that Lucas didn't direct, you know, Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. And
yeah, but he directed Star Wars.
He did. But, you know, you could make the argument that that Empire Strikes Back is the best directed of the three. And
it is.
You know, then you could sort of argue the merits of both Return and Star Wars. But in any event, I like J.J. Abrams. He has a modern sensibility while still paying respect and homage to things that have come before him. I love the look of that start that you know,
The Down Star Destroyer, right.
The Down Star Destroyer. I love there's one quick shot where they show one of the, you know, bad ships, the destroyers. You're going to beat me up because I don't know all the terminology. It looks like the matte paintings and the models and the old stuff, but with modern CGI where you need it and where you know you got to use it.
Right.
Excited. I'm very excited. I think it looks like a lot of fun. I got a chill up and down my spine when I heard Chewbacca make his famous noise. That was easily my favorite part of the whole thing. Do you know who's the cinematographer on it?
I don't.
I'll have to figure that one.
I know that when they announced that Lawrence Kasdan was going to write the screenplay with Abrams, I knew this movie was going to be fantastic.
Yep, and that's another thing, too. Looking forward to Lawrence Kasdan's involvement as well. All right, so why don't we go from here, and let's get into our main film.
I just want to say before we get into Heat that as shitty as the prequels are, they're still Star Wars movies, and they're still amazing. So
fair enough.
Whatever. Whatever. All right. So, God, fucking haters. So
I'm not a hater. I'm not a hater.
I know.
I'm a
student. I know.
I know.
It's all good.
I just, they meant anyway. So much to me, those three movies when I was a kid, and I waited outside for an hour and a half for Phantom Menace in front of the theater. I've never done that before. I waited in that fucking line, and the best part of the whole thing. The best part of the whole thing, in my opinion, was the 90-second teaser for Fight Club. And I've said it a million times
before. Oh, my God.
The best part of sitting in that theater to watch Phantom was the 90-second teaser. I was so upset, dude. But in any event, we'll do a whole podcast discussion where you can kill me about the prequels. And really, really quick, yes, Dan Mindell, who was an ex-Tony Scott guy, he's the one that's going to shoot the new Star Wars film. So that's why it looks so hot. So there you go.
Okay. All right. I need to digress from your hatred of the Phantom Menace. I get it's shitty. I know. But anyway.
But we can talk about a film that we really both truly love.
Yes. Nice segue. I wish I would have came up with that. That was a good segue. So we're going to be discussing Michael Mann's Heat, which came out in 1995. And to me, Michael Mann is one of my absolute favorite filmmakers. He directed and wrote Manhunter, which was the precursor of Silence of the Lambs and based on Thomas Harris's novel Red Dragon. And while it's different from the novel Red Dragon, which is one of my favorite novels, Mann completely encompasses the feel of it. So Manhunter is one of my absolute favorite films. I have a poster up of it in my place. And what strikes me about Michael Mann and Heat is this was the film that gave him the clout and the credibility that he has today. He made a lot of good films prior to this one. They were smaller. Last of the Mohicans was pretty big, and it was an excellent period piece film with an excellent performance by Daniel Day-Lewis.
And it finally made some money.
Right, and it was Heat. He brought together Robert De Niro and Al Pacino, two of the best actors that have ever lived. And he makes this epically long, as you called it, like a soap opera for men, which is exactly what it is. It is this epically long street film that is gritty and tough and hard. And I just absolutely love this film. And to me, when I watch this film, like when I watch most of Mann's films, he has his own visual style. And his authorship, I would say, has become making these gritty street films. I think he's done that with Collateral. He's made other films like Insider, which I think is his best film. I love Insider, but it's much different yet the same. Same with Ali. Love that. It's the same. He's fantastic. And with Heat, my absolute favorite thing that he's done with Heat, and he's done with some of his other films, is color tones. Man is huge on color tones. And the way that he sets the film up with a hue of a color or a scene with a hue of a color. And with Heat, it's apparent that it's blue. Different shades of blue, but the entire film is in this blue tone.
Yeah, he's been obsessed with the different subtle differences of blue throughout his whole career. Absolutely. I mean, there's a, you know, Collateral has that blue look. Thief at times has a little bit of it. The Insider has it a little bit, but absolutely, especially in
Manhunter definitely does, but particularly in Heat. I feel as if Heat is the full encompass. It just encompasses everything that he had done prior.
Yep.
And Heat really set the tone for him as a filmmaker moving forward.
Yeah, it's informed every single film that he's made moving on. Completely.
And for me, the blue tones. It's the blue tones translate into machoism. This film is about men, and it's incredibly masculine from the two lead performances from Robert De Niro and Al Pacino to the wonderful supporting cast of Val Kilmer, Tom Sizemore, Dennis Haysbert, Ted Levine, just this an incredible macho cast of these bad men. And not to say they're all bad, but I definitely think that the morality of the film is everybody's kind of together. You have these two groups. You have the cops that are led by Pacino, and then you have the thieves that are led by De Niro. And everybody is so comparable in this film. Man is showing like each side of the spectrum, I feel like, because what these men live by is a code of honor, a code of respect and loyalty and authority of the street. And I love De Niro and Pacino in this film so much because they are the same man, essentially, but on opposite sides of this like code of the street. I'm getting flustered thinking about it.
Yeah, it's wonderful how Mann basically made a film where you could take the protagonist and the antagonist and hold them up to a mirror and basically see the same person with subtle differences that separates them finally in the end. The notion of duality is explored here really well. And it's one of those movies where I, you know, given that it's 20 years old now, it's a movie that I have constantly rewatched. It was kind of funny. It was kind of funny last night while I was laying in bed. I was, you know, flipping through the channels and Miami Vice is on. And I said out loud to my wife, I said, wow, Miami Vice is on. I got to watch this. And then I see the only thing better would be if Heat's on. And I checked the guide and I couldn't believe it, but Heat was on at the same time. And it was like beyond weird. So and it was just so funny because we knew we were going to talk about Heat today. So I put it on and you're absolutely right. Just everything about Heat is basically the finest distillation of Michael Mann's obsessions. I mean, everything from the way that he fuses character, plot, location, action, drama, smarts. Everything has a reason, whether or not he's going to tell you explicitly what that reason is. He may ask you to do a little bit of digging. May ask you to do a little bit of legwork on your own, which is something I've always liked. I don't need everything spelled out for me. And he's definitely one of those filmmakers that, you know, you're off and running. You got to listen to the jargon. Guys will talk in code. You know, like half of Miami Vice is spoken in like what feels like an alien language at times for people, just because it's so heavy on the jargon and the cop talk. You know, to go back to a point that you raised, he's a filmmaker who's, you know, with a few exceptions, with Last of the Mohegans and The Insider, he's a filmmaker that clearly feels the most at ease in the crime genre. And, you know, from all the TV stuff that he did, Starsky and Hutch, Miami Vice, Crime Story, the amazing show that he did in the early 2000s called Robbery Homicide Division with Tom Sizemore, which was a stylistic precursor to Miami Vice in that he was using the, to Collateral and to Miami Vice for that matter, because he went all digital. Did you get a chance to see any of Robbery Homicide Division? Are you familiar with the show?
I didn't, and I really wish I could have seen
it. It's so good, and if they never put it on a DVD, I have a bootleg copy that I got off of eBay, which actually I believe Paul Rowland's Money Into Light, he's got my copy right now out in Japan, and he's taking a look at it. And it's just one of those things where he knows that world. Like, there are Scorsese knows his world. These great filmmakers, when they travel to the same well multiple times and they're not content with recycling everything from film to film, when you're pushing yourself on a form level, when you're pushing yourself on a narrative level, and that's the thing I've loved about Michael Mann. His most recent film, Black Hat, which was the first movie that I saw in the theater where I wasn't absolutely in love with it at first glance. It's a film I really look forward to seeing again. He almost goes abstract in that film at times. The plot is tangential to the expressionistic atmosphere and his unique ability to sort of, I call it man vision, just looking into the horizon and not being able to have an end, not having an end plane, just everything is visible. You're seeing into the night, you're looking into the homes of people and you're observing and that's the thing I love about his new digital aesthetic. I love movies that were shot on film. I love that film look, and I will always prefer that. But when a filmmaker like Mann uses the digital image in the way that he has recently, it's been exciting. Heat, I think, is easily his best crime film. I will agree with you. The Insider, I would have to say, is probably overall his most important work, because it took something that was topical and it was something that, it's an undeniable fact. Cigarettes are bad for you. They're going to kill you. And he made a film about a piece of information that we all know, and it was riveting. I mean, there are so few journalistic movies that are truly riveting when you know the end result. I mean, you know what the story is. It's not something that, it's common knowledge, the story of Jeffrey Wigand and the 60 Minutes fiasco of The Insider. And yet he was able to make that film incredibly cinematic. And I really want to see him get back to work with the cinematographer Dante Spinotti, who shot Heat and who shot The Insider and who shot Last of the Mohicans, and who also shot Public Enemies, which Michael Mann
shot Manhunter as well.
And I would love to see a reteaming of Spinotti and Mann on this new Ferrari movie that they're working on. But
with De Niro. I know. I can't wait.
One of the things I want to really bring up about Heat is how Michael Mann is a city guy. This is a guy that grew up in Chicago. From what I've read and from what I've listened, he wasn't necessarily on the mean streets of Chicago, but he certainly had a view to varying parts of the city. Experienced different things that, you know, maybe not everybody gets to experience. And what he's been able to do, which is so unique, is that he's been able to take his love of Chicago and transplant it to Los Angeles. And in Heat, the city itself is a character. It's this sort of dangerous, sexy, limitless, unpredictable landscape where anything can happen. And one of the things that I love so much about Heat are the locations. I love the industrial locations that he always shoots for, the parking garages, the water towers. They give off a sense of importance, of hugeness, of masculinity, if you will. And that's, like you've said before, the film is certainly, it's an exploration of the codes of manliness. It's about a guy, a cop, who's driven to find the one man that he knows he's got to find. And, you know, everything comes second. His wife, his relationships. And then you've got De Niro, playing just the most. I love how bold and blustery and big Pacino is in this film, and then by contrast, how tight and reserved and inward De Niro is. And
Pacino's so over the top and so larger than life in his performance, and then De Niro is just the antithesis of subtle good, of just internal acting, of just internalizing everything, and you see everything from a physical reaction or a body movement from De Niro in this film.
Absolutely.
He's so quiet.
I have really nothing negative to say about the film, but the one thing that I wish that Michael Mann had been able to keep in the film was the subplot of Pacino doing blow all throughout.
That exactly. Because that makes perfect sense to Pacino's character with his outbursts and his and how erratic he can be at times. I have no idea why he cut that out.
I'm going to go ahead and say that at the time, because he had had one major box office success with Last of the Mohegans, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that basically Warner Brothers said to him, listen, Mike, you can have your 3-hour runtime, but we've got to make, we have to make Pacino as sympathetic as possible. And I don't know what the reason was for them to take out the overt shots of him doing some bumps, because it would explain his vibrant outbursts at times a little bit more. Having said that, because Michael Mann's a smart guy, you can pick up and read around the edges. He's chomping his jaw. He's moving his mouth.
I agree.
There's, you know that there's something a little bit different, a little bit off about this guy. Whether or not he's doing drugs, whether he's not got a screw loose, whether he's just seen too much action, you don't know. But I think that what it would have done is it would have just added even more edge to this already sort of edgy,
yes,
big budget studio drama. And, you know, maybe if Michael Mann made Heat now, maybe he gets away with having his protagonist do some casual blow. I don't know. Maybe society's changed a little bit from the mid-90s to now. I mean, you've got guys lighting up joints in every single television show and movie that you can think of right now. And cocaine has certainly made its appearance on numerous television shows as a fun drug, quote unquote. So I'm curious to know if it was the society that dictated that cut from the final version of Heat or whatnot. Small quibble aside, it's just such a fantastic movie. It's so rich. And even though that the two of them are different at the end, there's just so much that's similar about them that you just got to love. And it's just this constantly shifting dynamic between these two people. Because are you going to tell me that you've ever watched Heat and you've not rooted for De Niro?
No. It's on right now.
Yeah,
it's just like I love... Yep. I love both of them equally.
I know.
And one of the things I absolutely love about this film is the audacity of Michael Mann to put De Niro and Pacino in a film together.
Mm-hmm.
And they share 15 minutes of screen, maybe a little bit more, 20 minutes of screen time. But you have that small scene at the diner, which is finally like the face-to-face confrontation of Vincent Hanna and Neil McCauley. And I love that name, Neil McCauley. It's so, I don't even know how to describe it. I just love that name.
Yes.
And, well, he did take it from a real life, Neil McCauley. But it's the audacity of just the entire film builds to the diner scene, but really builds to that climax where it's the two of them at the airport.
Yeah,
it's just the showdown.
Stunning stuff at LAX. You wonder how that was... No one's going to get that scene done now. All of those planes are going to be digital. It's an amazing sequence. And to say nothing of the now legendary shootout in the street, which, you know, from inspiring real life incidents to, you know, being a scene that has been ripped off by so many other filmmakers throughout the years, that shootout in the middle of the street is, in my opinion, the greatest single scene of action that I've ever seen put on film. I mean, it's startling. It's immediate. It's violent without being over the top. You get the sense that everyone is in mortal danger. It's one of the few movies where thousands of rounds of ammunition are expended. And yeah, actually people get shot. You know, it's not just like every bullet missing, somebody. And then you have the the moment when De Niro opened fires when he's trying to drag Val Kilmer out to safety and he opens fire on the people at the grocery store, it's chilling. And
it's
just, he's lost it. He doesn't care. He's just going to do whatever he has to do. And the desperation in that scene, you haven't seen at all from De Niro throughout the film. He's been a man who has had everything pretty much go right, except for, you got the Wayne Grove incident and everything else. But he's a guy that has everything under control, but doesn't allow these surprises that life throws him to make too much of emotional distress in his life. He's able to really keep everything compartmentalized until the end when, his hubris gets the best of him and he has to, he's got to finish everything that he feels he needs to finish. And I don't want to spoil the ending. I know it's a movie that's 20 years old and everybody could say, hey, you're crazy for worrying about spoilers, but it's possible that somebody hasn't seen it. So I don't want to truly say everything about it, but, it's just one of those films that's aged wonderfully over 20 years. It's an endless rewatch for me. And, like you said, the things that man accomplished in his work previous to Heat, he brought some of those elements to it and then expanded upon it from that moment. And then everything else after that, it seems, like I said, it seems informed by what he pulled off in this great movie 20 years ago. So.
Yeah, it's this film that's just this monumental piece of work that I feel like is man's time capsule film. For as fantastic as The Insider is and how important I think that film is, I think it all comes down to Heat as his masterpiece.
Mm-hmm. I would have to totally agree with you on that.
Rewatching the film a couple of times as of late, since we're doing the podcast on it, I do notice that I feel bad for every female character that we see in this film.
Yep.
Because of the overriding machoism and masculinity of all the characters. Ashley Judd is Val Kilmer's wife. Michael Mann's wife in real life, Diane Verona, plays Pacino's wife. Poor Natalie Portman. As Pacino's stepdaughter, who has this asshole dad, that we never see on film, but he's incredibly effective to Natalie Portman's life and her story arc throughout the film.
It is, and then, right. It is sort of this film that the bad things that men subconsciously do to women.
Exactly. Poor Amy. What's her name? Brennan.
Amy Brenneman, who's like all of like 15 years old in the movie. For God's sake, she's like kissed by the stork.
She's so sweet and gentle in this film, and she just gets into this turbulent relationship with De Niro, who's at least 15 years her senior.
Lonely in L.A., man. Lonely in L.A. will make people do a lot of different things. It happens all.
If you're lonely in L.A., you're a young female, you're gonna end up with the bank robber Robert De Niro,
yeah.
Who, by the way, has my absolute favorite line in the film when De Niro tells her that I'm alone, I'm not lonely.
Yeah.
I think to me that's my favorite line of the film, and I think that one line completely sums up De Niro's character.
And I still will always appreciate the idea that Michael Mann has that he would be able to have a man tell a woman that he is reading a book about metals, and she's still interested. And she's still interested in him. So
yeah,
I've always
exactly
the height of humor in Michael Mann world, because one thing we can probably both agree on is that Michael Mann is not a humorist, and I'm not 100% sure if he's ever going to make a comedy in his career.
That would be interesting if he did.
That would be interesting. So. All right. Why don't we? You want to get into our top fives for this week?
Correct. Our top five performances for this week, which were Nick's picks, is Mark Ruffalo and Jessica Chastain, two very great actors that I have loved everything they've done.
Yeah, it's
that
tough,
I've seen.
Huh? Yeah, tough to pick.
So I will go ahead with my top five Mark Ruffalo performances. Okay. My number one Ruffalo performance is last year's Foxcatcher. I was completely blown away by the film. I can't even believe that I didn't know the true story behind it. I was absolutely shocked that I didn't know the story. I have no idea how it eluded me or I never read about it, but obviously Steve Carell is fantastic in his performance that's just a transformation from anything he's ever done prior. Absolutely anything. This movie told me that, or showed me that Channing Tatum can act, and he is a very good actor. I was blown away by Channing Tatum in this film. Like, the first 15 minutes of the movie, I was just like, oh my God, this guy can act. And I absolutely loved Ruffalo. To me, he was the best performance in the film. As great as Carell was and as great as Channing Tatum were, Mark Ruffalo just blew my mind. He was so sweet and sympathetic, and he just brought this physicality to his performance that I absolutely loved.
Unexpected.
Exactly. He is such a great, subtle, and physical actor. It blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
My second performance that's my favorite of his was in Zodiac, and where he plays the detective that is hunting the Zodiac killer throughout the span of the film. And it was funny to me, both Foxcatcher and Zodiac were films that I didn't want to end. And I loved the story so much that I just wanted to keep watching, and I thought it was funny that the common denominator was Mark Ruffalo. My third film was Normal Heart, the HBO film that came out last year, 2 years ago.
About the
AIDS outbreak. Dealt with the AIDS outbreak in the gay community. I absolutely loved him in that. That was just a performance I was not expecting to like as much. And I was curious to the fact that he played it, but I absolutely loved it. My fourth one was Shutter Island, the Scorsese film with DiCaprio where they go to that.
I got to rewatch that.
The mysterious island to investigate how a patient happened to disappear. He plays Leonardo DiCaprio's new partner, and he's very Humphrey Bogart-esque in the film. He's the 1950s policeman detective. I loved him in it, and I thought he was perfect. I love Shutter Island. I just don't like the ending. I've rewatched it a bunch of times. Just can't dig the ending. Don't like it.
Okay.
But I know a lot of people disagree with me on that, but anyway. And then my fifth one was In the Cut. Loved that movie. I got a chance to buy it this week when I was at Half Price Books. Bought it for, I don't know, a couple dollars. Rewatched it. I think that's probably the first performance I noticed him in when I saw it for the first time. It was either that or Collateral. I can't remember which one came out first. I want to say In the Cut came out first, like a year before Collateral. I can't remember.
I think you're right.
But I absolutely loved him as like the sleazy yet sensitive cop.
Yep.
That was, I don't know, subconsciously tormenting Meg Ryan. I love In the Cut. I'm so glad I got to rewatch it. I haven't seen it since it came out on DVD for the first time.
In the Cut is extremely underrated. It's sinfully underrated. Nobody has seen it, and it really deserves reconsideration. It's fantastic. It should have gotten Meg Ryan a lot more work instead of killing her career, which is just like, I don't get it.
I think her plastic surgery that made her look like she had Jack Nicholson's smile from Batman kind of may have helped kill her career, but
that didn't help her out either. But all right.
What are your top five? I'm ready to write them down.
All right. So my top five for Mark Ruffalo, my number one is going to be Zodiac, because I feel that it encompasses pretty much all of the traits that make him a great actor. He's funny, he's dramatic, he's likable, he's ragged, he's got all the different things. I love the bow tie. I thought that David Fincher used him perfectly, contrasting against Robert Downey Jr. and Jake Gyllenhaal. And I agree with you. Zodiac is an amazing film. I wish it didn't end. It's one of those great movies that you could watch over and over and over again. My second pick is going to be You Can Count on Me, which is a nearly flawless film as far as I can see it, written and directed by Kenneth Lonergan. Absolutely love this film. I remember reading the script for it about a year before it came out on a plane, and I was crying and laughing and crying. And I have a sister, and it's a great brother-sister movie. His chemistry with Laura Linney is wonderful in it. Rory Culkin plays Laura Linney's son, his nephew. He shows up on the bus, you know, to her house smoking a J, and I just right away you just like the guy. He's just a great performance. My third pick is going to be Begin Again. which was last year's film with Keira Knightley from John Carney, the guy who directed Once, the music guy, music filmmaker is what I call him. This is a soulful performance. He's hilarious. He's disheveled. The chemistry that he has with Keira Knightley is infectious. I'm not sure if you've seen Once or Begin Again, but I highly recommend you see them both if you haven't. Just enjoyable as all get out, really. I mean, there's nothing about that movie I don't like. The Normal Heart's going to be my number four. As you said, unexpected. Never, after seeing Mark Ruffalo in so many movies, you just don't expect to see him in that role. He was terrific. He was passionate. He was emotional, bold, loved it. My fifth pick, I couldn't choose between Foxcatcher and What Doesn't Kill You. And I'm gonna go with What Doesn't Kill You simply for the fact that I can highlight it here on the podcast, and most people have probably heard of Foxcatcher. What Doesn't Kill You is a terrific Boston crime film, written and directed by the character actor Brian Goodman. Mark Ruffalo playing a version of Brian Goodman, who was a criminal before he became an actor and a filmmaker. Wonderful movie about Boston crime, families, brothers. Ethan Hawke is Mark Ruffalo's brother. Terrific rapport between the two of them in the movie. So that's going to be my number five. And I just have to say, and I'm just going to rattle them off in rapid fire. Foxcatcher, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Margaret, The Kids Are All Right, Collateral, In the Cut, Shutter Island, Where the Wild Things Are, We Don't Live Here Anymore, All the King's Men, Blindness, Reservation Road, The Brothers Bloom, The Avengers, The Last Castle, Ride with the Devil. The guy has been on fire for 20 years.
I just hate that he's in The Avengers. I get it, but I hate it.
But I have to be honest, he made me care about the Hulk again. He's the only actor. He wants to have some fun. He wants to have a little bit of fun. I don't deny somebody that when you've been making a lot of dramatic movies. And if somebody came up to you and said, hey, you want to play the Hulk? You want a boatload of money? At least they got Mark Ruffalo.
That's fine. Make me sound like the asshole for not liking it. But whatever. You know, I just always looked at Ruffalo as like he's like Peter Falk. He's just like this little disheveled character actor that's absolutely on fire in everything he's been in.
And I
love it.
Yes, and I agree. And for me, that was the brilliance in casting him as the Hulk. So I honestly, the last thing the world needs is a Hulk standalone movie after two other Hulk ones. But I would go see it if it was Ruffalo. So I'm just saying.
I liked the Edward Norton one. That was fine.
Yeah, I like
Edward
it.
Norton. I own it.
And I still think the Ang Lee one is cool more than most.
Yeah.
People. That movie. That
Weird Nick Nolte.
Yes, that I didn't like the ending of that film, but that movie moved and felt and breathed like a comic book, especially the editing, the panel editing. It was brilliant. But Ang Lee is not, you know, Ang Lee's a total amateur, right? I mean, come on, let's be honest. That doesn't know what he's doing. Do your Jessica Chastain.
All right, my top five Jessica Chastain is Tree of Life is number one. That's the first thing I saw her in that I remember or took note of it. She is so sweet and sensible in that movie, yet she is haunting because she's living with Brad Pitt, who's just the over-domineering man. And I feel so bad for her in that film. Numerous times, she moves me. That film moves me each time I watch it, but in particular, Jessica Chastain is just a delight to watch in that film. I absolutely love her in that. The second film, number two, is A Most Violent Year. I was incredibly blown away by her performance in that. And her and Oscar Isaac played off of each other so incredibly well. The chemistry between them, I absolutely loved. And I loved the how, in a way, she's almost the antagonist to Oscar Isaac. I loved it. It was just such this complex and small performance. Not a small performance, but she's just...
She punctuates the film perfectly.
There, that's a perfect way of saying it. Yes, she punctuates the film perfectly. After you see Oscar Isaac, she's the punctuation, and it's just like, whoa. A lot of the time it's an exclamation point, some of the times it's a question mark. I loved her in the film. Number three was Zero Dark Thirty. Loved her in the film. Didn't care for the film as much as I thought I was going to. Really looked forward to seeing it. I thought the movie was good. I didn't think it was great. I absolutely loved her in it. I thought she was fantastic. Loved Gandolfini in there. I just want to throw that out as Leon Panetta.
Yep.
Number four, Take Shelter. That's another film where I wanted to like more than I did. I was super excited to see it, but Jessica Chastain I thought was fantastic in it. I felt so bad for her in that film because her having to live with Michael Shannon, who's having these premonitions or whatever he's having in the film. And then my number five, this is a movie I saw a long time ago, and it's called Stolen. And it's with John Hamm, Josh Lucas, and James Vanderbeek. And it's a small indie film that I remember renting on demand because I thought it sounded really interesting. And it's a film about two parallel storylines where a child goes missing in this, I think it's set in Texas. I believe it's set in Texas, where a child goes missing. Both the cases have striking similarities. And the film cuts back and forth between present day and the 70s, I believe, and showing the two comparable storylines with John Hamm's son goes missing, and then in the 70s it's Josh Lucas's son that goes missing, and Jessica Chastain is in the 70s portion as a waitress that Josh Lucas kind of strikes up a relationship with. Yeah, I think I have it somewhere. I should rewatch it. I haven't seen it for a while, but I loved her in it, loved John Hamm. I really enjoyed the movie. It was this movie that nobody's really ever seen, and I loved it. So that's my top five.
Yeah, thank you for putting it on my radar. I'm going to put that in the queue. I'm going to look that one up. Yeah, Chastain has been somebody who I've been taken with the moment that I saw her in the first thing, which I'm trying to even remember what the first time I saw her in a movie was, because she's had so many great films over the last couple of years. My number one pick is going to be The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby.
I haven't seen that yet.
And I would highly recommend that you watch The Them. This is that movie written and directed by this new guy, Ned Benson. It's two films. It's bizarre. He made a film about a relationship between a guy and a girl, Jessica Chastain and James McAvoy, who's excellent in the film as well. And similar to the recent show on Showtime, which is great, The Affair, where it takes a look at an affair from the two perspectives, the male and the female, this is a relationship film that tells the same story through two different POVs. And
I love that.
And there's three different versions of the movie. There's The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, Them, which is the director's cut, the way the guy wants you to see it. It's close to 3 hours long, and it's a melding of the two movies that the Weinsteins forced him to cut out of the one director's cut. They didn't want to release one movie. They wanted to release two movies, and they didn't do anything with any of it except basically just bury it and then put it out on Blu-ray. If you buy the Blu-ray, you get all three versions. It's fantastic. She's amazing in it. It's the best thing I've seen her do yet. Zero Dark Thirty is my number two. I think I like the movie more than you overall, but we can both agree her performance is beyond focused and strong and forceful and just absolutely kick-ass. You know, you root for her for the whole time. Tree of Life is going to be my number three. Every single time she shows up, she's just luminous in the movie. She's the prototypical mother figure, the mother that everybody has or wants or had for a moment or never had, whatever you want to call it. It's a wonderful performance. It's a very specific movie, obviously very emotional, and man, she was great. My number four is a film I definitely liked, I think, more than you, Take Shelter. I was utterly blown away by that movie, especially the ending when, like you said, you felt bad for her having to live with, and I don't want to spoil it, you feel bad for her having to live with Michael Shannon's lunatic the whole film, and he's unbearable kind of guy. But when that ending comes and you say, what is this? I think it's a very cool film. It's sort of unclassifiable.
I need to rewatch it again.
I think it's super underrated. It kind of came and went. Michael Shannon is a force of nature in that movie. I'm just a big fan of that film. My fifth pick is going to be A Most Violent Year, because she comes in to this otherwise sort of sedate Sidney Lumet-esque crime drama and she just brings the heat in every single scene that she's in. This playing this gangster's daughter who sort of knows a thing or two that she's keeping from her husband. And what's really cool is that she went to school with Oscar Isaac. So I guess think this is the first time that they've been in something on screen, and she had been wanting to work with him ever since they worked together in school. So I think that that might have been why their chemistry was so damn good. And then, you know, Interstellar, The Help, Lawless, Texas Killing Fields, The Debt, Coriolanus. I mean, come on. She's just been on fire the last few years. Where do you stop? So, and then we want to just quickly talk before we run out of time here. Some things we basically rewatched over the last week. I know that we're always looking for, you know, older movies to watch, you know, bounce off each other, get recommendations. We've got all these great guys out there on Facebook. We got Paul Rollins and any number of other people that have, you know, been throwing suggestions our way. And that's the thing I love is when we talk to these people online, they open up, you know, our world, our cinematic world so much. Is there anything that you've seen over the last week you want to just detail real quick?
I did watch A Most Violent Year, like I said. I watched Heat a couple times, but I haven't had a chance to really revisit a lot of stuff or see stuff for the first time. I did recently purchase Domino, 15 Minutes, In the Cut, a handful of other films that I picked up cheap that I hadn't seen Domino, and I know that's one of your favorite films. So
one of my favorites.
I wanted to watch that, and I wanted to watch In the Cut for Ruffalo. And
15 minutes
you've talked about, and I haven't seen that since it first came out, and I wanted to watch it again, so I picked that up.
It's not great, it's just consistently interesting, and we'll talk about that one. I'm going to rewatch it too.
Right, yeah, I haven't really watched anything or bought anything aside from those. So I know you've picked up some stuff and watched a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I've been on fire watching a lot of stuff. I'm really getting into the 70s stuff that I missed. You know, I being a child of the 80s, a lot of the stuff that I was watching was the early 80s, mid 80s stuff. So I didn't really get a chance to see some of these great movies. I watched Cinderella Liberty last night, which is a Mark Rydell film with James Caan, Marsha Mason, Caan playing a sailor on shore leave. He hooks up with this pseudo hooker and he falls in love with her and tries to change her life. It's great. It's messy. It doesn't end with a bow on it, just like the great 70s movies never did. It spoke to real life. I enjoyed it immensely. Thought it was really good. Marsha Mason, which is fantastic. It's her second movie, which is very surprising to find out. I had a chance to rewatch Arlington Road, which I still think is just one of the best recent political thrillers. I know that it's probably about, 15 years old by now.
Yeah, I just bought that too to rewatch it again.
Such a good flick with such a great twist at the end. And, it reminds me of sort of a modern Parallax View, which I love, and I can't wait for that to hit.
Yes.
Somebody's got to put the Parallax View out on Blu-ray.
I think Criterion's going to do it. That's my guess. That's my hunch. I think Criterion will put it out eventually.
It would be fantastic to get the Criterion should do like the Paranoia trilogy. All the President's Men.
Of Pakula, right.
And just give me the three, give me the four or five movies that Pakula made back then that were all like that. I rewatched William Friedkin's The Hunted, which I really enjoy. It's like
love that movie too.
Stripped down, a lot of visual storytelling, a riff on First Blood, lots of fun. I've been finishing up watching some 70s cop films, Busting from Peter Hyams. So good. Really surprised by how much I liked it. Overall, I expected to enjoy it. I really enjoyed it. This is the one with Elliot Gould and Robert Blake as a pair of like pimp slapping squad detectives. They're taken down.
What a great pair up.
Oh, it's just so good. So entertaining. And honestly, when you look at Peter Hyams' work, the master of the B movie, this is one of his best movies. And I think it was his first film. He made two made for TV movies and then came out with Busting in 74, which was compared a lot to Freebie and the Bean. And the Super Cops, which I also watched, which was kind of a sloppy mess. It was more Police Academy than anything else, but it was still kind of fun. I do want to shine a spotlight on a very strange little German movie called The Strange Little Cat. And this is a very bizarre film. Loved it. It is a unique take on Franz Kafka's The Metamorphosis. For 75 minutes, through static camera work, you watch as a mother and wife comes apart mentally in front of her family in a very, very, very quiet, very internal manner. And if what I'm sounding, if what I'm explaining sounds dreadfully boring, it's not. It's very interesting. And the filmmaker, who's his first film, a guy named Roman Zerker, I'm probably not saying his name right, he intercuts the family pets, the cat and the dog, throughout the film to make a point about, I would gather, complacency and the roles of everybody within one house that is slowly getting smaller and smaller by all the visitors that are showing up. It's a really good little film. It's not even 80 minutes long. And I think that it promises probably more cool stuff from this filmmaker in the future. I hope he gets a chance to do something else. And other than that, that's about it. I saw The Stuntman, the Richard Rush movie, which was just a blast with Peter O'Toole and Stephen Railsback. We could probably do a whole podcast on The Stuntman at some point. A true product of auteur-driven filmmaking in the 80s, a troubled, turbulent production, this really interesting satirical take on Hollywood and action films, and it's just a really cool film and further evidence of the fact that Richard Rush did not get the credit he deserved and didn't make enough movies. So that's about it for me.
Excellent. I haven't picked up any collectibles as of late. I did go out and I got the Star Wars Lego Cantina from A New Hope because I was all jazzercised from the Force Awakens trailer. So I look forward to building that and then trying to find space somewhere in my place to put it because my place is already overflowed with all sorts of shit. So that's about it for podcast two. I really want to stress and say thank you to everybody who's listened and supported us. We've gotten overwhelming feedback, and it's just absolutely unbelievable to me. And just thank everybody that has listened and given us feedback. It's really been incredible, and it's very rewarding, and we love doing this, and we're really just ecstatic that people are enjoying it as well. And we've gotten a lot of constructive feedback and stuff, and I just want to say, the fact that Gary Young, who's the screenwriter of Harry Brown, a film we both absolutely love with Michael Caine, listened to our podcast and told us how much he loved it just, blew my mind. I thought that was fantastic.
I agree. The response really has been wonderful, and it's made the prospect of doing this every week even more fun because we know that there are people who are enjoying it and share the same taste in films. And, if doing this or contributing to writing reviews and stuff gets somebody to watch something that they've never heard of or never seen or thought twice about, or, oh, I didn't like that the first time around, but maybe I'll give it a second chance, that's the best thing I could ever say about the whole thing. So,
right. I agree 100% with you. To wrap things up, what we're going to be discussing next week is Bob Fosse's final film, Star 80, which is a film I absolutely love, and I know Nick ordered it, and I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say about it. Really quick on Fosse, All That Jazz is, to me, I think that's the best film I've ever seen, and it is one of my absolute favorite films, too. That and Manhunter are kind of interchangeable, but I think Bob Fosse, for the handful of films, four films that he made, was an incredible filmmaker, and I absolutely love him. And the two actors we're going to be talking about next week for the top five performances is Eric Roberts, who is the star of Star 80, and then Ellen Barkin. So,
and I look forward to seeing Star 80 for the first time. I've heard a lot about it. There's people online have told me about it over the last couple months. So I'm glad that you made it our featured film for the week, and I'm glad that the Warner Brothers Archives has it available because you can't get it through Netflix. So I'm excited.
Yeah. So thank you, everybody who's listening. And, Nick, you got anything to say before we sign off?
No, just thanks a lot for the support, and we look forward to doing more.
All right, guys. We'll post this up right now. Right. Thanks, everybody.